Welcome to Last Orders, the Spike podcast all about freedom and the nanny state. In this episode, we discuss the woke World Cup, the fight for free speech on campus, the fake news about test and trace, and whether or not we're all going to freeze to death this Christmas. Hello and welcome to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked. I'm joined, as I have been in the past 47 episodes, I looked up the other day, Chris. Almost a milestone. But Chris Snowden from the Institute of Economic Affairs, how are you doing, Chris?
I'm not too bad. My knees are giving me a bit of jip.
This just comes with the age, I guess, doesn't it?
Well, yeah. Alcohol-related injury as well.
Do you want to tell the people what you did here?
No. No. It's too embarrassing.
We'll leave that for the post-bag section, which I'll ask you a question about it. And we're delighted to be joined in this episode, your third time on the show, Julia Hartley Brewer, presenter of The Breakfast Show at Talk TV and veteran journalist. How are you doing, Julia?
And personally, I was not involved in any way in his injury.
We'd like to make that
clear. For legal
now.
Purposes, I should state that.
So
confirm.
We've got a lot to talk about today, but we should start with the World Cup, which now, obviously, all
is
the
there
attention.
A World Cup on?
There is, actually. And it's actually about football, whereas up until this point, it seemed like it was about knee taking and rainbow armbands and the like. Now that actually it's begun, we can actually start enjoying the sport. But there was a lot of politics going into this, Chris, a lot of virtue signalling, a lot of discussion about whether or not the England players would take the knee, whether or not Harry Kane would wear his rainbow armband, which he didn't after he was threatened with being carded for it. Just to kick off, what have you made of all of the carnival of virtue signalling around this Qatar World Cup finals?
I've enjoyed the football. I think it's a great World Cup, really. I saw James O'Brien, that is one of his little viral video things, in which he said that everything is political and politics is everything. And I just think that's the worst possible way of looking at the world. I don't think James O'Brien likes football. I think he likes rugby, being a public school lad. And the problem is that a lot of people who don't really like football feel they need to have a take about everything that's like, you know, current affairs and the World Cup's current affairs. So rather than just ignore it, they decide, you know, how can we politicize this? And, you know, we knew that the World Cup was going to Qatar 12 years ago, and everyone knew that it was a bad idea. Everyone knew it was a result of colossal amounts of corruption, and it was totally unsuitable to hold a World Cup, hence it being held in winter. And we knew that, you know, it wasn't the most progressive country going, you know, and I don't approve of their stance on, you know, gay sex, which is to potentially cut their heads off or, you know, execute them in some way. But, you know, that is the way they are. We knew that before. They are following a, you know, 1400-year-old religion, and most of the neighbours in that part of the world have a very similar view. So
we've had 12 years to form another world body.
Should have been in England.
What I loved this week really was Gary Lineker coming out saying that the BBC should have stood up more of a, not just Qatar, but they should have spoken up in 2018 about the Russian World Cup. I mean, it's a stunning and brave opinion, I felt.
Yeah.
Well, my thing is about them taking the knee and all of that stuff and the rainbow armbands. A, don't say you're going to wear a rainbow armband if you're then not going to wear a rainbow armband after you've been threatened with a yellow card. Personally, very glad they didn't wear a rainbow armband, because I don't want a yellow card and a risk that's going to affect our progress through the tournament. But the thing is, the problem with that, of course, is not wearing that rainbow armband, the One Love armband, that means, of course, that homophobia will continue. But the good thing is they took the knee, and that's good, because that solved racism. In fact, I'm amazed that racism wasn't solved 2 years ago.
When, so it's kind of evened out then.
Yeah, respect. I mean, you know, when footballers started taking the knee. So, you know, you give with one hand, you take away with the other. The thing I find so extraordinary is the idea that these things matter so much, having the word love on the back of the Belgian players' shirts and the like, and buckets, hats and this and that. And they only care about this stuff when they can make a virtue of, oh, look, I really care about it. There are loads of other ways of making your views known. They could give some of their vast wealth to charities campaigning on these issues. This is just a chance for everyone to say, oh, look at my progressive views. Look, these are the same people who insist that we should have multiculturalism in this country, who absolutely insist that we should respect the views of people in this country and their religious views. Well, I hate to tell you, there are an awful lot of people who follow an awful lot of religions, including Islam, largely the religion of the Middle East, who hold the view that homosexuality should be illegal and should be punished by prison or worse. Now, I don't agree with that. I'm appalled by that. But that is the view that many, many, many people hold in that part of the world and some in this country. And it's fascinating to me, the when we are and when we aren't supposed to respect other people's cultures.
Mm-hmm. That has gone to pot. I mean, it's also been a great demonstration of what virtue signaling is, because when you get into those arguments, people will often kind of hide behind the ambiguity. They'll be like, why are you criticizing people for taking a nice moral stand against racism or homophobia, whatever it is? Whereas,
but they didn't.
Exactly. As soon as anything, they could have lost anything, even just, you know, one player for a couple of games, all of those principles go out.
But then
the window.
Alex Scott was praised, the former England footballer and BBC presenter, who I've got a lot of time for. But she was praised because she wore the One Love armband because she was so much braver than the players. Well, she wasn't going to get a yellow card and be sent back home to London,
exactly.
Was she?
That's always the classic thing, is if you've actually got anything to lose, the virtue signaling goes out the window quite quickly. It is just repeating the chattering class's view back to them and expecting applause.
It's an
awful
London dinner party conversation, isn't it? You know, the other thing I thought was fascinating was when the FIFA chief exec did that mad hour-long rambling press conference.
Shall I read out? I've got the quote here.
Yeah, please do. Yeah.
I want it in the accent, please.
I'm not going to attempt that. But this is Gianni Infantino. This very strange press conference, as you were saying, Julia, and at one point, near the beginning, he launches into this tirade. Today, I feel Qatari. Today, I feel Arab. Today, I feel African. Today, I feel gay. Today, I feel disabled. Today, I feel a migrant worker. And it goes on and on. And on my favourite bit, though, is then he suggests that he understands what it is to be oppressed because he was ginger.
Ginger, yeah. Cool.
He also had freckles.
And he was the child of migrant workers from Italy and Switzerland or something, which meant that he obviously knows what it's like to die from dehydration after working 80
degrees. His surname literally means little baby.
Says a lot.
But also this idea that when he says that, we're supposed to go, oh, that's ridiculous, because it is ridiculous. Yep. I feel gay, I feel this. And yet the same people who are mocking that, it's an outrage. It's just outrageous insult to the people who are dealing with that prejudice. But they're the same people who tell us that when a man says, and on a Wednesday afternoon, if I put on a dress or wear my high-heeled shoes, high at ears odd, then I feel like I'm a woman. And we're supposed to respect that, otherwise we are transphobic. Well, which is it?
Because he did identify as a lot in that short space of time.
He did, didn't he?
But it was because also there's this tendency to, he just did the virtue signaling thing badly. Loads of companies and organisations, you know, do the most meager thing where they put up a black square for Black Lives Matter and they get applauded by everyone. But just because everyone knows how upfront the corruption is where FIFA is concerned, well, he just did it quite badly.
That's what disappointed me about FIFA. Like, if there's one thing you should be able to rely on from FIFA, it's just like balls out. We don't care what you think.
Yeah.
Give us the money.
All about the money.
Highest bid wins.
Sell Budweiser in the stadiums, otherwise you're not getting the World Cup. And they backtracked on all this stuff and added this pathetic, self-hating woke washing. As you say, very unconvincing woke washing to it. And I don't really understand why. I mean, he's just having a nervous breakdown or something. It felt like that.
I think my favourite bit was when he said that, if anything, we can learn from Qatar, sort of paraphrasing here, because they've opened their doors to migrant workers, whereas Europe puts up the drawbridge.
Well, they've certainly done that,
yeah. They've opened up the doors and then they closed them again and took their passports because they can't leave while they're on 1.5 pence an hour. Yeah, I mean, great system. I quite admire the whole FIFA, we don't care, we're just busy getting money into our Swiss bank accounts. My issue's always been about the World Cup bids is, can we please stop the pretense of like, oh, we'll send along, I don't know, Prince William and Tony Blair as well, and David Beckham to bid for a World Cup. Put the money in the accounts and get the hell on with it. Our issue in this country is we don't pay big enough bribes. You know what we did last time when we bid for the World Cup? We gave people leather satchels. How shit is that? If that doesn't say we're at the end of empire, I don't know what does.
Before we move on, are people enjoying the football so far?
Loving it.
I love it, yeah.
I'm not doing so well in any of the leagues I'm in, though.
Mm.
Family league, lobby league, nothing. I'm in the same one as Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer.
I got Iran and Saudi Arabia in the sweepstake.
So
particularly. Oh, Saudi Arabia, of course, won. The Japanese beat their oldest allies.
And England are actually starting to play football, which is good, rather than having meetings about.
Can I say, though, also, the Saudi-Argentinian match, really difficult to pick a side on that one because, you did cheat in that World Cup and you did invade part of our territory. But you're not the Saudi. It's a really hard one to pick aside.
There's a few like that, isn't there? You know, VAR's been the biggest problem. That's what people should really be protesting about. Absolutely disgraceful VAR rubbish already. And you get these stupid pedants on Twitter going, actually, I think you'll find it was offside because his elbow was offside.
This, yeah, like, we need one to hair from his
and we'll have another 45 minutes of injury time. I mean, we'll be lucky if we finish this World Cup before the next one.
Have you signed up to become a Spike supporter yet? Spike Supporters is our thriving donor community. Supporters can get access to a host of exclusive perks, and I've got an extra special one to tell you about today. On Monday, the 19th of December, we have Toby Young joining Brendan O'Neill for a very special live recording of The Brendan O'Neill Show. And this online event is exclusive to Spike Supporters. Toby and Brendan will be discussing the tyranny of big tech, how to take on cancel culture, and much more. You'll be able to watch the event online. Plus, we will also be taking questions from the audience. So, if you're already a Spike supporter, you can register for the event now in the Spike Supporters Hub. If you're not a Spike supporter, why not sign up now? You can do so for as little as £5 per month by going to spiked-online.com/supporters. Then, when you're all set up, you can claim your ticket. Once again, that's spiked-online.com/supporters. Thanks so much and see you there. We should move on and talk about freedom of speech on campus. Evergreen issue, but it's back in the news because of the government's Higher Education Freedom of Speech Bill is working its way through the House of Lords at the moment. And as whenever it hits the headlines, there's a lot of discussion about how essentially this isn't really a problem. So, and that this bill in particular is just stirring culture wars for no apparent reason when there's much more important things to talk about. The bill itself is broadly about toughening up the duties on universities and students' unions for freedom of speech, extending legal provisions that previously were only for universities to student unions, and toughening them up, making them more enforceable, and most controversially, introducing this legal tort, which would allow people, if they couldn't actually go through the complaints process successfully, to sue universities and students' unions if they're no platformed, if they're kicked off of their course because of their views and so on and so forth. But despite the kind of mounting attention to this particular issue, Julia, and the number of people who are now almost household names for being no-platformed or hounded off a campus, whether we're talking about Kathleen Stock or anyone else, there is still a very vocal group of people, particularly in Parliament on the Labour side, who are just saying this is just made up. How can people continue make that?
Yeah, cancel culture completely made up. How many people need to lose their jobs? How many people have to go to employment tribunals? And how many students are being kicked off just for saying things like, I think it is women that have vaginas, not men. Now, that might not be something that Keir Starmer believes. Do worry about how his relationship is going with his wife. On that, I have to say. But these are really basic things to the 99% of sane people in this country. I just find it extraordinary. So don't have a rule or don't have a pass a bill, which means that people can sue us if we break the law. Damn bloody right we're going to have a law that protects people. I think back to when I was at uni in the, I think my teenage daughter calls it the olden days, late 80s, early 90s. The idea that if someone was going to speak on a university union or that someone came to any event at your college, that they would have a different opinion from you and that in any way would be traumatic for you or something you would try and prevent. People would have looked at you. It's not that that wasn't a common view. People would have looked at you like you were stark, staring insane. And quite rightly. When did it change? Because we've been blaming the students, like these mollycoddle kids, cotton wool, no one's, everyone, you come last in the race and you still get a gold star and all of that stuff. And they get to uni and the madness continues. This is actually, I think, coming from the academics who I think are largely unemployable in any other field. A lot of them are completely mad. And I keep hearing from academics who've been driven stir crazy by this. For instance, the Brexiteers who had to keep quiet because no one would sit next to them at lunch because they voted for Brexit. And now on the free speech issue, even saying things like they don't believe that men can magically become women and they're being treated as social pariahs. We absolutely need this bill. We really do.
And from what you're talking about as well, it's a good example of the slippery slope in action. Because what No Platform was about 1974, No Platform for Fascist National Union Students Policy. Almost immediately that started getting extended to other groups, Zionists famously in the 80s, as well as over time it gets extended to Islamists, it gets extended to other kind of just generally right-wing groups on certain university campuses. Then around the 2000s it started to be all bets were off. You had like Eminem songs being banned in Sheffield and so on and so forth. But it is that it is a good example of how if you allow censorship in this area, it will spread. Because we have gone from no platform for fascists to no platform for feminists in, you know, the space of a few decades.
No platform for sane people. Yeah. Tell us what we are.
I'm not sure it is the academics. I mean, evidence base on this is quite limited, but I was in Exeter University last night and...
Legally?
Just stop doing that, we'll tell you.
I was told by the people I was speaking to, which was the Freedom Society. Hello, people from Freedom Society, if you're listening, that they had previously had a guest on who was going to talk about fatherlessness. And I think that was more or less all the, you know, the talk was billed as being about.
Children need fathers.
Well, that was, you know, I think, what he ended up saying, but I don't think that was explicitly in the advert for the talk. And about a dozen. University groups, student-led university groups, wrote this open letter condemning it, demanding the thing be ended. And it was everyone from the Labour Society to, you know, period poverty, apparently have some kind of voice in Exeter. And these kind of groups, kind of like, this guy must not be allowed to.
Hey, fathers have periods too, okay?
This guy must not be allowed to say whatever poisonous thing we think he might be about to say. And to be fair, they stood up, and Exeter's pretty sound on free speech. But... I say it's only one anecdote, but I it's not just the academics. I think there's a lot of horrible societies.
The academics have allowed it because the academics should just simply say, shut up. You don't know what you're talking about. You're 18. Learn from us.
But it's not even the academics who make the decision, is it? It'd be ultimately like the vice chancellor or somebody.
Well, the academics should start disciplining if they had any guts, which they don't. They should start disciplining the students who do this. Any student who tries to control other people's ability to speak freely and express themselves other than when they're breaking a law, no, you're not allowed to shout, I'm going to rape you, to somebody, those students should be severely disciplined. And if a repeat offence, basically thrown out of uni. Because you shouldn't be able to do that with impunity.
And it is really interesting with the whole debate in Parliament over this particular bill, where particularly from the Labour side, what they're really worried about is that even lawful speech could be uttered on campus. So you had, I think, Kate Green, former Shadow Education Secretary, saying, well, this is just going to be a kind of charter for climate change deniers and for Holocaust deniers.
Oh, no, imagine that. Basically, climate change deniers. They never say something.
All hell will break loose. So there's
I won't be able to leave the house.
They do this 1-2 move where they say, this isn't really a problem, but actually we'd be very upset if this censorship was taken away.
Again,
they show their arse every single time.
It's this really, really strange idea, isn't it? And I remember this going back to, I was on my local newspaper in the East London Advertiser, and East London back in mid-90s. And then, we had the BNP, there was a BNP councillor elected. And there was a big debate later on about Nick Griffin, the BNP leader, going on Question Time, this big thing, which actually completely exposed him. But I argued to my local paper editor at that time, you know, we should cover this guy. We should talk about this guy. You expose these people. The cold light of day really exposes how stupid and ignorant and pretty nasty a lot of these people are, but mostly how stupid and ignorant they are. You always defeat bad ideas with good ideas, but you can't defeat them if you never discuss them. And especially with social media now, people just disappear off into their little echo chambers, and these things, you know, fester and get far worse. Whereas actually, if they're discussed publicly, you know, my thing is, again, it's like the climate debate. Well, if you can't debate me on this, other than saying, oh, well, Greta disagrees with you, or shouting denier at me, then you haven't got a very good argument.
The thing I don't quite understand about this bill, which I must admit I've not read as much about as perhaps I should, is...
You weren't aware what you're talking about.
Is the Labour Party going to vote against it on the basis that they don't think it's a problem? Because it seems, if you don't think it's a problem, why would you be bothered about the bill, right? It's like the people who are anti-fracking want to keep the ban.
Yeah.
And they say, well, nobody ever wants to frack. This country is useless for fracking. No companies want to do it.
There is no gas, they say.
You wouldn't be bothered about it being legal, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, they're backing all kinds of amendments to try and tie things up a little bit. I mean, they garb it seemingly in kind of arguments around this will affect the autonomy of universities, or this will create kind of lawfare against, you know, university vexatious complaints, all of that kind of stuff.
As opposed to vexatious complaints against students and against, I mean, with every cases, it's not just visiting speakers or academics, it's actual students wanting to just say, you know, things that they believe, which are in most parts of this country, in most parts of the world, considered to be not even remotely contentious. And even if they were contentious, if someone genuinely believes that, you know, black people or Jews or women or gay people, whoever it is they hate that week, are inferior and shouldn't be allowed to do certain things or whatever, I'd rather know about it. Mm. And then I can argue against it and prove how stupid they are to them and to other people. But I think it's better that we know about it.
You would think that would be
how does it work in practice? So let's say I'm at the university, some association, and I decide to invite some Qatari over to say why we should execute homosexuals.
Not sure if they'd let you say that even legally speaking, but
really?
Let's say homosexuality is a sin or something. Let's go with that.
Okay. Then the vice chancellor says, no, you're not allowed to hold this meeting. Mm. Then the vice chancellor gets taken to court and prosecuted for
their argument would be that there would be they've used an awful lot of time with the women, the TERFs, you know, supposedly transphobic women who just think that, you know, women are women and men are men. And many other people, the argument has been that there's going to be some sort of public disorder. And to prevent that, because other people are threatening to prevent that, we are going to stop you from having that event. That's justification. Whereas actually the argument should be draft in 200 police if you have to.
Yeah. And that's in that bill as well, where they won't use security costs as an excuse to get rid of people. But it seems like you would have complained to the regulator. If that doesn't work, you could pursue it in the courts effectively. And it's worth saying as well that there's problems with this bill like any other bill. Yeah. I'm kind of slightly less skeptical about it now than I was previously. But I do sort of think the problem is so deep and entrenched that to the extent this might help a bit, the general climate, like that policy exchange report a couple of years ago where something like only 40% of people would feel comfortable having lunch, this is academics, having lunch with a gender critical feminist. Yeah, really. Just being seen with them tells you about how.
I mean, they're probably worried we're just going to steal their lunch. I mean, it is genuinely terrifying, the idea that you can't hear from or sit next to and share your cheesy whatsits with someone who has a different point of view from you. I mean, these people would never last around the Christmas table at my family. We go hell for leather on virtually every topic. Everyone has a different opinion. And then it's like, right, okay, who wants Christmas pudding? And we just carry on and go to the next topic. But in no way does that, I can't get my head around why so many people now are troubled and traumatized by someone holding a different view from them.
Make sure you never miss a Spiked article by signing up to Today on Spiked. Today on Spiked is our essential daily newsletter. It goes out every weekday evening with a roundup of all of the articles and podcasts that we published that day. And there's also some exclusive commentary from the Spiked team. To sign up, just go to spiked-online.com/newsletters. That's spiked-online.com/newsletters. And another thing that the MP Carl Turner can't get his head around in a very awkward transition there is the test and trace system.
Seamless
and its
segment.
Cost. So this has been a sort of ongoing attack line, which is actually complete nonsense. But do you want to tell us what Carl said and the discussion around this?
Yeah, he tweeted that the government has spent £37 billion on the COVID app, which is this like deathless trope people somehow believe. I mean, don't get me wrong, I believe that the government is very inefficient. I believe it wastes a huge amount of money.
But big believer in the good the government can do. Over
even
here.
I.
Mrs. Snowden is clearly sighing right now.
Even I find it hard to believe that the government could squander £37 billion on an app.
I wouldn't put it past. Right?
And this, we're going back a couple of years, obviously.
Do we mean the app, the one that everyone pretended they were doing when they went into the app?
Yeah, the one that gives you your little
the one that you
QR
go,
oh,
hold on a minute, and you just press madly on your phone. And then,
yeah, the one that allowed you for a while to leave the country and come back again, which probably did cost a few quid. You know, I think it actually cost 30 million, which is still quite a bit for an app, but I guess it was various other elements around.
Took them a while to get it right as well. You can understand why that bill started.
Exactly. But there are, and I would challenge the listeners to go on Twitter any given day and just type in £37 billion app or something like that, £37 billion Dido Harding in particular. I'd forgotten all about Dido Harding until I think she'd been put in charge of the Dominic Raab investigation or something like that. And then all these people.
There's always a job for Dido, isn't there?
There is, isn't there? Yeah. I mean, there's definitely cronyism going on, but not to the point where the Tories physically handed her £37 billion and allowed her to produce an app that would cost, you know, a lot less than that.
So the lion's share of it was testing, is that?
Oh, nearly all of it was testing. Yeah, the tracing thing happened for a bit, and you can argue about whether it was very successful or not.
And the cost of handing out thousands upon thousands of those test kits.
Thousands?
To each school. I mean, you know, my daughter just handed them. I said, I'll stockpile them for when we need them.
Right, exactly. It's free. So everybody stockpile them. Stick them, not me, because I'm really care. But, you know, there were people proudly saying, I've managed to get like 100 lateral flow tests. Here they are in my drawer. And then the kicker came sometime early last year when the £37 billion was running out. Mm. And the big debate was about whether we need to start spending even more money on these bloody tests, given that the Omicron wave had kind of come and gone and it basically been a bit of a non-event.
And also, we all had it at the same time.
Everyone had COVID.
Just assumed, if in doubt,
didn't need a test. Just assume you've got it unless told otherwise. And then at that point, people twigged that this testing, track and trace, which is effectively 99% testing, was costing £2 billion a month. And you got people with classic stuff on Twitter. You got people going like, oh, so we can't afford to spend another £2 billion next month on testing, but we can afford £37 billion on test and trace. They're literally the same thing. What do you think the money could? So there's this sort of weird meme in a corner of left-wing Twitter, which will forever be obsessed with Dido Harding and this imaginary £37 billion app. And it will never die in the same way that the idea that the Bank of England spent £65 billion bailing out the pension funds and Liz Truss created this £30 billion black hole. They're just these completely made-up figures that just live in infamy.
If only these people could get so upset about all the other costs, like to children's mental health and to, you know, cancer patients untreated and everything else that's damaged our economy. But no, let's fixate on the fake number.
I like the attack line is about government waste in relation to the procurement of an app rather than anything else. But yes, you're right, Chris, it has become... it's like Dido Harding is like the Patrick Minford of COVID or something, just like this midwit obsessive. We'll just bring them up all the time to try.
It's the name, isn't it? It's the fact that she's called Dido and she likes racing horses and stuff. And she was a friend of, who's she a friend of? Johnson or was it Cameron? Or
yeah, she's married to someone, isn't she?
Yeah.
Who was involved in those governments. I feel like I should know that.
No, Kate Bingham was.
Kate Bingham.
She did.
She was actually quite good.
Yeah.
I'm not saying Dido wasn't.
Statue to that.
I really don't know. But when you see these people pop up again and again getting these jobs, it is, let's face it, it is dodgy. It's weird that this woman who, I think she was in charge of TalkTalk, wasn't she?
Yeah.
Not
very well. Yeah, they lost a lot of information. I think, didn't they? It was a massive data leak. Yeah.
She was in charge of
basically ideal person to give
exactly set up an app,
So let's talk about, again, the coming winter and a lot of the concerns about the spiralling price of energy, but also how people can do small things in their own personal life to try and change this. This has been up until now a kind of recurring sort of slightly humorous story because an energy company will say put on two pairs of socks or whatever. But now we're actually seeing messaging from the government. Grant Shapps is going to announce a plan for this public information campaign around Christmas, encouraging households to cut their energy usage by 15%, turn the thermostat down 2 degrees, put on a jumper, et cetera, et cetera. It is also being talked about quite explicitly as a kind of dry run for when we all need to reduce our energy use for net zero and so on. But Julia, what have you made of this?
I mean, news of this. If you want to use less energy and have a lower energy bill, turn your thermostat down. I mean, no shit, Sherlock. Thank you very much for that. I think, frankly, if you don't know that, then you deserve to have a high energy bill. Who hasn't already done that? My husband knows that, you know, living with me, a high energy bill is a cost of doing business. I am freezing cold all of the time. I have the heating on in June, hot water bottles. I don't keep warm. My husband's northerner and therefore basically sits in his pants for most of the year going, for God's sake, why is it tropical in here? But yeah, even I'm turning the heating down. I mean, you know, looking at those direct debits, but it's just so patronizing stuff. But worse than that, I think it's really sinister as well, because actually what this is all about is the message that we should all be cutting our energy use. And we see this in the EU, that 15% across the board, every country needs to cut their energy use. And a lot of the Eastern European countries going, well, we're only doing that to help Germany. Well, Germany were the idiots who said, oh, we don't believe in nuclear power, but we're going to import all our electricity from France, which uses 80% nuclear power. And we're going to take our gas, 80% of our gas from Russia. Well, you know, you got yourself into that mess. My daughter, when she was 3, could have told you that was a dumb idea, and you did it anyway. But basically, we are giving in to basically rewarding the incompetence of our governments across the board in Europe. But, you know, I just care about our one. For years failing to build up proper energy supplies, that, you know, reliable fuel that was secure and that was affordable. Huge number of things they could have done in terms of nuclear power, fracking, energy storage, gas storage, loads of other things. And they didn't do any of it. Oh, so we're going to pay the penalty now. And that will be a penalty we continue to pay for many years to come. But also, the fact that we are basically giving in to the green lobby and their insanity of basically wanting to drive us back to the Stone Age. age, which is that we're horrible vermin, we're virus on the face of the planet, we're the problem on the planet. And if we weren't here living these wonderful lives and using energy and having microwaves and central heating and things like that, then everything on the planet would be fine, and therefore wanting us to use less energy. And you know, I'm willing to put up with a higher energy bill on bloody principle. I had a guest on my show today saying about, oh, it's terrible, all these buildings lit up and people got Christmas lights. Fuck off. People are allowed to have Christmas lights. We've had two Christmases cancelled in a row. People are allowed to have Christmas lights and walk down Oxford Street and go, isn't it pretty? This hair shirtism, it's not just about helping people with their bills. It's actually the beginning of this is how we're going to live now. And I think we need to fight back against it.
What do you think, Chris?
I appreciate what Julia's saying, but from a personal point of view, I'm quite enjoying being a miser.
I knew you would.
You're in your element, aren't
you? Yeah, it's been really good to have an excuse.
We don't have heating on anyway.
I've only had the central heating on 3 times so far this year, and 2 of those occasions was only because I lost an argument with my wife about it, and it was only on for an hour.
The long winter nights must just fly by.
I've got newspaper up on this like little window where the air comes gets sucked through, so that's sound. I bought a 1/4 ton of coal, well not coal because Gove banned it, but smokeless fuel, which we're gradually getting through. A neighbour's tree fell down during Storm Eunice earlier this year, which I helped chop down with my chainsaw, and it gave me half the wood, and it's good quality wood, burns nicely. So if things get really cold, we light a fire.
And I think if it gets really cold, your wife's going to light you.
I think it's good. I think it's good. I've set myself the challenge of having lower energy bills this year than last year, even though the price of energy has doubled. And I'm on track at the moment.
I feel like you make a great survivalist, really. Like this is maybe a few
one of those Channel 4 shows
away from, you know, having.
Yeah, I think I'd be all right.
3D printing guns for yourself and stuff. Yeah. Whatever it might be.
My husband always threatens to just go off grid. You'll never find me.
What,
I know where I'll find him. I'm going to find him in Chris Snowden's shed.
Chris Snowden's commune that he's building up.
Sat around my wood fire. You know, I have 2 jumpers.
I'm picturing lots of clothes with tassels on. Yeah. You know those people, they wear tasseled clothes.
He's the one sat right here.
Who are you talking about?
You can try and deny it here, but we've all seen the photos. What? Anyway.
Honestly, I have no idea what you're like talking about.
Shall we reach into the postbag?
Yes, please.
For the postbag.
Postbag.
It's great to hear it live. That's lovely.
You're not going to use that, are you? You've got to use a professional double track version.
Maybe do a bit of both. let's have a look. So we've got a few questions here. Question here from Meg. Hello, Meg. Dear last orders, very formal. Why, when the tax burden is the highest since the war, is the country falling apart? What is it all being spent on? Julia, can you
relate
to that?
That's a good question. Well, debt repayments at the moment and interest repayments. This is the thing. I spent a lot of the summer asking cabinet ministers on my TV show, can you tell me a public service that works well? And I did one of the Tory hustings and asked that question of Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss. Remember those heady days? life seemed quite normal. And I think they both struggled. There were quite long pauses. And you just think about it. There is just nothing in this country that is functioning well. And yet we pay a lot of tax. The terrible thing is we still pay an awful lot less tax than a lot of our European neighbours. But I'm not sure that most British people are willing to pay those extra taxes to get the more efficient services. And I'm not entirely sure our government would deliver better services if we did pay those extra taxes.
Oh, do you think we should pay more tax? Is that what you're getting at?
No, I'm just saying that my big thing is that we should have an honest debate about, we say, oh, they do so much better over there with their wonderful bullet trains or their healthcare. Oh, you and your fancy getting an appointment within a year of going to the doctor stuff. But they do pay much, much higher tax.
Some of them pay a bit more. A lot of them don't. The Australians pay less than us, for example, and that's a pretty decent country in many
ways. You have to live in Australia.
So what's going wrong then, Chris? Big question.
Well, Julia's quite right about the interest payments. £120 billion.
Was it like second only to the NHS budget or something?
Yeah.
Everything's second only.
You're never going to catch it with the NHS budget. It's literally half the NHS budget, more than half the NHS budget. And, you know, people, you know, not naming any names, did warn that this would happen for all this cheap money. There would be a reckoning. So yeah, massive amount of interest payments, terrifying amount of interest payments, really. Plus just funneling endless amounts of money into the NHS.
Which the diversity managers, net zero managers.
Well, right. And you can always say that these people shouldn't be in work. And obviously you're right, but you get rid of them, you save a few million pounds, right? We're going to borrow £177 billion this year, right? I don't think anyone can genuinely say, oh, if we cut this and cut that and cut that, we can balance the books. Nowhere near. We're just in massive amount of trouble.
I think there's an awful lot of people in the public sector, as in the private sector, who don't do anything. The presenteeism and CCing everyone on an email, and the working from home is getting bad as well. But an awful lot of people who are in work just don't do anything. There's no what no, when you ask people what do you do and they tell you their job title. No, what do you do?
Yeah.
What do you actually do? I'm not saying I'm doing anything useful. I'm not what Al Murray would call essential personnel.
I'm a head of lifestyle economics. Everyone understands that.
providing. I introduce you on my show. I'm like, even I don't know what he does.
I don't really.
Come from a long line of directors.
He just sits and moans near Brighton.
The inventor of lifestyle economics. What more do you want?
Let's have a look at a Nanny State question here, Chris. A bit of inside baseball for you. So a question here from Michael Bracken. Hello, Michael.
Hi, Michael.
What role does local government play in the creeping nanny state? He's talking about alcohol licensing as a particular issue, over-regulation of specific businesses. He says he's got a sense of this himself and wants to know what you think.
Interesting question. Probably not to most people, but to me.
I'm going to doze off for a second.
They're very heavily involved in it. The local government association's always lobbying and tweeting about stuff that you wouldn't think has anything to do with them. Given the local government's had its budget cut by, I don't know, around about 50% over the last 10 years, you'd think they'd be focusing on the basics, wouldn't you? Rather than going about gambling. And we can't allow this new off license to open because more people will get drunk, and let's ban smoking in the parks. But they go on about these things all the time, which I guess takes us back to our previous question. Like, why is government so inefficient? It's because a lot of these people are doing things that they shouldn't be dealing with. They should be, in the case of local government, working on potholes and bin collections and the obvious stuff. But they are quite bad for it. And the local public health directors, of which there are about, I think, 53, this is a stupid thing Andrew Lansley brought in with the Tories. He got these local public health directors all over the country. And these were the people who were going to, take it back to the old days when public health was a local thing. Mm. Because in the old days, public health meant sanitation. Do you know what I mean? and like quarantining people who had, typhoid or something like that. Yeah. And now, of course, it just means nagging people about their smoking habits or telling them to exercise a bit more and stuff like this, which, of course, is what they end up doing because that's the easiest stuff to do. So you have these public health directors who are paid. They're all paid six of the figure. Some of them are £150,000. And they just turn up at council meetings and mither on about how, I don't know if we should allow this pub to stay open for another hour. Look at the evidence on availability and alcohol, blah, blah, blah. They're just a complete nuisance and a waste of space. And when push come to shove during COVID, they were lost. They just didn't contribute anything. I was following a lot of these guys' Twitter accounts.
Weren't they the people who were keeping schools closed in some areas?
They'd be nagging for that kind of thing. But basically, they did nothing. I follow the Association of Public Health Directors on Twitter and various other...
One of eight people to do so.
But I follow a few of them. And throughout the entire pandemic, they were just going like, the government won't tell us what to do. They won't engage. We're here ready to do shoe leather epidemiology. We're just not hearing anything. The government clearly thought these people are useless. There's no point even involving these people in anything to do with infectious disease. Let's give some money to Dido Harding and Kate Bingham.
They'd spend that $37 billion on that app.
They did, didn't they? Yes. So I heard.
So just fine. Let's go back to politics. A question here from Alan Kerr. Hello, Alan. After the next general election, with Labour, unfortunately, storming into power, how long do you think, Julia, it will take for a true democratic Conservative Party to regain power? Or do you think this authoritarianism is here to stay?
I think relatively soon. I have to say, I have been pondering, God, as bad as these Tory government is, wouldn't it have all been worse under Labour in the last few years? And I thought, actually, no, Labour would have done exactly the same, only worse than what the Tories have done in the last few years on economy and on COVID and on everything else. But we at least have had an opposition, because the Tories then would, I think, have been more opposed to various things. We'd have had some more of a debate, which might have been a good thing, as opposed to Labour going, "Oh, no, do it longer. No, no, do it harder. No, you know, I mean, do it earlier," which is basically what Keir Starmer says about everything. Poor Mrs. Starmer. But this is the issue. But I think
can
next time around, do it. But I just think, I mean, I still think it's not a slam dunk in terms of what happens in the next election. That said, I have no idea who I'm going to vote for. A lot of people tell me they think they know how I vote. I've actually been a floating voter pretty much all my life. And I'm appalled by all of them, to be honest with you. And I think there were an awful lot of people in the same boat. You've got those Red Wall voters who went over to the Tories and to Boris Johnson because of Brexit and because Labour were offering Jeremy Corbyn and the second referendum. And are they going to go back to Labour? The polls say they are. But I wonder, when push comes to shove, whether a lot of those people will vote. I think an awful lot of people simply won't vote, and that is a very big issue. But I certainly think a Labour Party getting into power, when all they've managed to do in the past was, right, we're just going to spend everyone's money. You know, Gordon Brown, put everyone on the payroll. I mean, they're working tax credits here, child benefit there, have this, have that. You know, you put everyone on the payroll, everyone, you expand the public service, you're going to get an awful lot of people who are going to vote for you. If they can't do that because there isn't the money and they try and borrow it, we see a run on the pound and all those issues that we've seen under Liz Truss, then things get a lot harder. And if you've got a Labour government that's promised so much, the promised land of a Labour government after all this time, and then they don't deliver what people with pie-in-the-sky economics think, because that magic money tree is basically burnt down, I think that might be quite an interesting proposition. Yeah. I tell you what, it's going to make for really good radio and telly. That's all I can say. Because part of me thinks, just for the good of democracy, I think the Tories should be out of power. I think they've had too long a run, and I don't like anyone who thinks that kind of it's theirs for the taking. And I think give everyone a little bit of a reality check on what a Labour government would do. Well, a Labour government under Keir Starmer.
It wouldn't do anything very much different to the Conservative government.
Yeah, but they'd be expected to do it. It's about expectation management.
Yeah, but I tend to think that the Labour Party is probably the only party that actually reform a lot of these public services. They won't make them very good, but they might make them a bit better. You know, you have Wes Streeting talking about bringing some sort of marketisation to the NHS. The Tories just can't.
Well, Tony Blair did more than any Tory government.
Yeah, exactly. Right. That's it. The Labour Party can actually do these things because they are trusted with the NHS, but the Tories are totally not trusted with the NHS. And all they can ever do is say, we're going to give it more money, with more money. Yeah. So I'm not particularly worried about the Labour Party getting in. I think the Conservative Party have done a terrible
I think we've had
job.
The Labour Party anyway. I don't think it makes that much difference.
Well, exactly, yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I don't really care that much.
It will be interesting
to see a Labour Party that is genuinely constricted in terms of what it can borrow. But I suspect what they'll do, given that they keep going on about this Green New Deal as being their thing for growth.
Yeah.
I think they'll just say, well, that doesn't count as borrowing. That's investment, you know, that's infrastructure spending. Yeah. And they'll get away
Let the gilt markets decide on that one.
Well, I don't know. The gilt markets might be a bit more generous than you think, actually, because we've been borrowing a shit ton of money for a very long time. The gilt markets haven't particularly reacted badly to it. You know, they reacted badly to a mini budget that was not explained well, to put it most mildly, right?
I know this is difficult for you to talk about.
And even then, you know, yields went up like 1% point or something like that, you know. So a lot of it was.
I must say, it does feel depressingly like back to sort of Cameron Miliband sort of dancing on the head of a pin sort of territory. I know some people are kind of almost think that sounds favourable in comparison to the kind of turbulence we had recently.
What if Nigel Farage gets back into the game?
It wasn't seen as that at the time. It was seen as Red Ed versus,
chaos with Ed Miliband.
Yeah, right.
It's funny how that turned out. Yeah, it's a good place to end it. Chris, Julia, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.